everyone. Welcome to 2022, welcome to Filmstrips, and welcome to the Dark Side. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir. And welcome, welcome, one and all. Hear ye, Filmstrips call. Happy holidays. Welcome back from our bonus episode. We're kicking 2022 off with a regular one. So, Dave, who are we and what are we doing with everyone's time this time?
Why, yes, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, we look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The important thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed on the preceding episode. Now, the last two episodes that you probably saw in your feed, though, were bonus episodes. First up was our annual year-end recap, in which James put us through our paces as the quiz master as well there. We ended up with a clear victor, but with, you know, fairly tight results in this instance.
That is still under appeal. I just need to wait for my lawyer to graduate law school.
All right. But in this instance here, there was also then me and Ross took a look at for our annual crossover, looking at the Showa Godzilla era of films there. So both of those in your feed, you can look back at it. But yes, we're connecting back to the last regular episode of that we did in 2021. And what that happened to be a little film by the name of Sour Grapes.
Yes, it was the one and done film from Larry David. And from there, who do you even follow? We decided to follow editor Priscilla Ned Friendly to the magical year of 1983. I was 3 years away from being born, and a little film came out by a man named Martin Davidson, and that film is Eddie and the Cruisers, which, also fun connection, is the second time around the holidays we've seen Michael Paré in a rock and roll film. is another wonderful 80s rock and roll movie, and it has a cast featuring Tom Berenger, Michael Paré, Joe Pantoliano, Matthew Lawrence, Helen Schneider, Michael Toons and Toons, Kenny Vance, and Ellen Barkin.
Yes, and for the record, no, not that Matthew Lawrence, okay? Just whoa. So we're,
My goodness. I mean, I think it's kind of funny that Michael Paré, who we previously saw when we looked at Streets of Fire, aka one of Andrew's all-time favorite movies, Eddie and the Cruisers and Streets of Fire are really the only two notable Michael Paré films that come to mind. And his career really didn't go the places people thought it would. But it's so interesting watching these two films together because there is something spiritually linked between the two films. Dave, do you understand what I'm talking about?
Well, along with the fact that was it Kenny Vance who also popped up in Streets of Fire as well? Somebody did from this movie as well. But it's the fact that they are both these sort of rock and roll throwback movies made in the 1980s with absolute conviction in what they are. And in the case of Streets of Fire, I will go to bat for it is a legitimately great movie that also happens to be completely bonkers.
Yes.
Eddie and the Cruisers, cards on the table, I think for both of us here, is a bonkers film that is extremely entertaining. Might be a little bit hard to say it's a good movie in certain respects.
Well, but, I mean, not to tip too early, though, but it's interesting, though, because the two films, I think, they're both insane in their own ways, but they're working in very different modes. And it's even further interesting because Michael Paré is basically the exact same character in both of them. But, I mean, seeing as we began by talking about how nobody remembers Michael Paré except us on the holidays, that means probably there's a good chunk of people who, despite recent revisiting of Eddie and the Cruisers as a cult classic, probably haven't heard of this film. So, Dave, before we dive and drive with Eddie and the gang, why don't you bring us all up to speed and give us the rundown?
Eddie and the Cruisers is a 1983 drama co-written and directed by Martin Davidson and adapted from the 1980 novel of the same name by P.F. Klug. Tom Berenger stars as Frank Ridgway, a teacher who once belonged to a popular 1960s rock group before its demise after the mysterious death of its frontman Eddie Wilson. Ridgway begins to reach out to his former bandmates and reminisce about the past when a series of break-ins to their homes leads him to accept the possibility that Eddie isn't dead after all. A critical and commercial flop upon release, Eddie and the Cruisers gained a cult following thanks to its hit soundtrack and regular airplay on HBO during the mid-1980s. The film was followed by a sequel in 1989. Coming up after film strips, Lily Tomlin shares her heartwarming home videos for the making of I Heart Huckabees.
So I guess maybe to sort of inroad onto this one, I think most of us, and certainly most people listening to a show like ours, the 10 of you out there, and a hello to each. I think we all remember, certainly around the mid-2000s, where there was that sudden wave of not only musical biopics, but prestige musical biopics. I think as the point of reference, look at, I think, the always underrated Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. It sort of hits that Twin Peaks tier where it is satire of Oscar bait while also being, like, great Oscar bait material. But, I mean, as we've talked about before, like, genre theory sort of holds that when a parody film comes out, it sort of reached the end of a certain cycle. It's interesting, though, to look at a film like Eddie and the Cruisers, because not only does it predate that, but it's also a musical biopic about a fictional character. And, I mean, like, Elvis, for instance, was in movies, but I don't think there was ever, like, the Elvis Presley story. And, like, Gary Busey did the Buddy Holly story, but, I mean, that's a film based on a real person. So here we have a fictional biopic about a man who never was, and I guess the central question is, why do that?
Well, okay, so the origins of this film, really, you gotta begin with Martin Davidson. Now, Martin Davidson was a filmmaker who more or less gets a start in the 1970s. He's probably the most famous film he did prior to this was something by the name of The Lords of Flatbush, which I have to admit I have not seen. It's just one of those titles that stands out at you as like, well, yeah, that definitely sounds distinctive, if nothing else. But he was sort of coming out of the mostly independent side of Hollywood filmmaking. Like, it's like you're so close to the center, but not quite. And he really wants to do a film like many people around this time did, which was looking back on sort of what he thought of American, you know, music and sound of the late 50s and into the 1960s and really try and capture that there.
And And I mean, if you think about it, even now, like that era of American music and sort of like the idea of the power that music can have as like a social force in that, that is something that is often lionized and maybe overemphasized in some respects. But, you know, I think that's when you're making a biopic, you're sort of bound to put on rose-colored glasses because, you know, it's like that thing you do, maybe as a point of comparison, where that's a film that's as much nostalgic for its era as it is for, like, the Romana Clef musicians it's talking about.
Well, absolutely. And, I mean, and again, I think Davidson, it's not just that he comes by it honestly, but that sort of baby boomer nostalgia wave was riding high throughout the late 70s and into the 1980s.
The 80s needs its own American graffiti, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, it's understandable where he's coming from, and he ultimately comes across a book that he uses, that he decides to become the basis for his film, and that is Eddie and the Cruisers, written by P.F. Klug here. Now, my understanding is Klug was a writer of a number of novels. He also worked writing the article that apparently was the basis for Dog Day Afternoon quite a few years earlier. However, I just want to bring this up because Klug does have a website here where you can actually buy their books here. And I just want to read the write-up for the book that's listed here and what he has to say about the films here. a fictional examination of my weaknesses, lifelong weaknesses, for the songs of my youth. Hits come and go, the products of the season, but they return, sometimes they seduce and reproach. The novel is set in New Jersey, much of it in the vineyard where I had a summer job on the town newspaper in 1962. The novel and the film have been described as a rock and roll Citizen Kane. To this, I do not object. The first Eddie and the Cruisers was directed by Martin Davidson. The sequel, Eddie Lives, is a talent-free embarrassment. So, there's something to be said for honesty. But yeah, I mean, this novel...
It once you see this film, the idea that there is a sequel becomes even stranger. and that's without even watching the film itself. It's even further amazing because, not to spoil the ending here, but this is a film that critically and commercially underperformed. And so... things definitely go wrong. We certainly, have to admit that from the outset. I guess he's not wrong, though, because without being one of those ironic reading types where it's like, Fight Club is actually the same movie as Alien, or doing, like, sort of that novelty reading of a film.
Yeah.
Like, this is a film that, in many respects, is, I think, at times consciously emulating Citizen Kane. But that's kind of the answer of why do a fictional biopic-style film. The answer is, in this case, you wrap a possible murder mystery and an ongoing stalking-slash-heist plot line.
Well, okay, yeah. So, and this is the thing. So, okay, Davidson comes across this novel. He secures the rights to it and starts putting together this film basically independently. Now, the film... he ends up putting together a team that he writes the script along with Arlene Davidson, who I'm going to assume is either his wife or maybe a
I'm going to guess it's a spousal thing, and yeah. I'm fairly sure that this is the only writing credit that Arlene Davidson ever had.
According to the IMDb, that is the case, so bar an error there, that seems to be what happened. But again, we end up getting, you know, cinematographer...
Look up what year they got divorced. That may confirm it.
Yeah, who's to say? but yeah, I mean, we get this... probably the big get, though, for Davidson is his music supervisor and music producer, which is Kenny Vance. Now, Kenny Vance might not necessarily be a name that many people are familiar with, but he was of Jay and the Americans.
If you've seen Guardians of the Galaxy, come a little bit closer. That's
yeah. Yes, yes.
So this guy knows how to write a hook.
Exactly, and he was in that era of 1960s pop culture that Davidson's trying to capture. So he certainly starts apparently interviewing Vance quite a bit and taking in a lot of his experiences in addition to his own experiences and what the novel has there, and starts putting together the screen version of it. And he sets about trying, probably his big thing, though, is that he wants to, you know, not only tell the story, but find a musical artist that can capture, you know, the feeling of the, like, 1950s music, and then see how it evolves throughout the 1960s, which, okay.
Well, yeah, because given what this film ultimately becomes, and indeed any kind of film like this, sort of the bar that you have to clear is the music has to be good enough that you can believe it would be popular. Like, if you're making a film based around the music, it has to be good music. Otherwise, you have failed at what you're trying to do.
Well, yeah.
I think, also tipping our hand, though, the music that we do get here is pretty awesome.
Oh, absolutely. Because and here's the thing, because there's a bit of a complicated answer to this. Because, yes, ultimately, the band that are who Vance guides Davidson towards is John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band. Now, it's hard to say how much people necessarily know them now. They had the misfortune of always... they were a New Jersey bar band, much like the characters that we're going to encounter in the film. But they had
They also had the misfortune of being named the Brown Beaver Band.
Well, I see that as being the kind of name that could actually kill. I mean, look, we had Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band around the same time. It's not a you know, Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show. Like, there's plenty of things that sort of work with
and
that.
And how famous was Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show in history? Point proven.
Point being, the real misfortune, though, is there was another little artist from New Jersey who kind of hit the zeitgeist a little bit before them in this instance. And who might that be?
A little artist who clearly had no influence on the presentation or music of this film. A little man by the name of Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, exactly. So,
who,
I mean,
again, weird missed connection, was supposed to provide the song Streets of Fire to the film Streets of Fire, hence why it's called Streets of Fire. And then that didn't happen, so Jim Steinman had to come back and write another song, and they had to rebuild a theater set to film it.
Exactly. What ends up happening is ultimately Davidson puts together a cast that includes a number of up-and-coming actors at this point. So, yes, we get Michael Perret, who's going to play the titular Eddie Wilson this film. We got Tom Berenger, who, Berenger... this is pre-Fear City Tom Berenger, but...
I think right now, just to get it out of the way, Tom Berenger gives a really good performance while being so... I don't want to say miscast, but given how his character is presented, and given that it's Tom Berenger, like, choices were made, and, like, it's so strange at times when he has to play, like, young, naive freshman, and he looks like a 50-year-old teacher for the entire film.
Well, this is the problem with Tom Berenger, is, look, you know... as good an actor as he can be, he is one of those actors who's always looked old. Like, it's impossible. Like, there's no point where you look back and say, yeah, remember when Tom Berenger was, like, a handsome young man?
I close my eyes, I hear Tom Berenger, and I immediately think Platoon.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Like, he's never, ever had, like, he was never that matinee idol type or, you know, sort of wishy-washy, almost meek individual, like the kind of character that he's going to be asked to play in this film is. And again, Berenger is trying. This is not a case of Tom Berenger looking at this and giving a performance that's completely out of sync with the movie it is. It's just...
Also, I am predicting right now that the Simpsons post Ross is going to do is Superintendent Chalmers leaning over and, you think they really filmed this in Atlanta?
Exactly. Yeah, that could be the case. But yeah, I mean, we've got him in there. We got Joe Pantoliano, and if you know who Joey Pantoliano is, A, he's awesome. B, when we get into what's done with him in this movie, it simultaneously makes perfect sense and will also highlight one of the big problems slash most amusing aspects of this movie as well.
Also, like, Joe Pantoliano, Joey Pants, is certainly famous to a certain... It's like there's a certain dividing line on some actors. Like, if you know Keith David by name and don't just call him, hey, that guy, I think it signals a certain kind of film fan. Yeah. Among them, though, Joey Pants, as far as I know, the 90s is when he really became a figure in that circle. I don't know much about his early career. I'm pretty sure this is the earliest film I've seen Joe Pantoliano in. And given that he's so frequently the older, slimy guy, seeing him play younger, slimy, thin guy with hair is kind of off-putting.
We got Ellen Barkin, who we've had covered a couple times in the show. Fantastic. She hated making this movie, and by her own admission.
I saw casually looking about this film. It's just one of those, no, I'd rather not talk about it kind of things.
Exactly. And then we got Michael Toons Antunes, a.k.a. a member of John Cafferty in the Beaver Brown Band, the only one to get cast in this movie.
Yeah, and that's what I can't figure out, because much love to Wendell, but, like, he is the only actual musician in the film, but I am Like, I know the rest of the band is just miming the instruments, so why would you cast a musician in the role? Because as we soon see, I am pretty sure he does not have a single line of spoken dialogue in the film.
I don't think you're wrong, and what makes it even funnier, he's one of the few cast members who also appears in the sequel.
Oh my god.
Which, yeah. And then there's Helen
but
Schneider.
But I think right now, as we're laying it out, it's like, well, the casting makes perfect sense, but the way you're using the people that you're casting doesn't really. And that's the kind of film we end up with.
Yeah, so to make a long story short, the point is this film was supposed to be a big, you know, they figured it would be a big summer release in 1983. Davidson ends up, you know, selling it to, I forget which studio or sort of mini studio offhand. The problem is they end up releasing it in September of 1983 when the youth audience they figured they were targeting with it was all going back to school. And this thing basically crashes and burns at the box office. But there is a silver lining to this story, because while the film tanked at the box office, two things happened. First of all, the soundtrack for this movie goes over like gangbusters, and for good reason. It kicks ass, if you've listened to
and,
it.
And Joe Cafferty also got the official stamp of approval, a movie tie-in music video.
Exactly. The other big thing that worked in this film's favor was that this is when cable has really made its way into North America overall, and HBO in particular apparently reran the hell out of this movie for like weeks on end whenever it came on. So most people ended up catching this on cable over and over again, and that's where the cult audience really came to be, so much so that they actually tried re-releasing this film in theaters based on its television performance, where it still proceeded to bomb a second time there. So, you know, it helped it.
And I mean, that's the thing. Like, this, as we were saying before we started recording, like, this is a film that, it's not a case where it's so bad that it's good, but the reasons why you end up really appreciating a film like this have nothing to do with its overall quality. And it's a nice reminder that you can separate the two, and not to be like, let people enjoy things, or never be critical of what you consume. But, like, sometimes you do need to acknowledge that separation, and this is a film that's great to do it on. But, like, again, it's just the mechanics and the structure and the approach to the film clearly can work, because what's further interesting, Todd Haynes, Velvet Goldmine, have you ever seen it?
I've heard of it, but I've never actually watched it.
Dave, do yourself a favor, because, you know, this one, you think, this is insane, using Citizen Kane to frame a mystery about a rock star's disappearance while nostalgic for an era. That's what Todd Haynes does, except it's in 1997, and it's about David Bowie, while it's also a tie-in to 1984 and a direct reference to Citizen Kane. It is insane, but again, it also works, because the music brings it. And, I mean, there is something just inescapably nostalgic about an era in this film. But the irony is, it's not nostalgia for the 60s. It's nostalgia for the 80s. And the soundtrack is absolutely why.
Okay, I will definitely have to go check that one out for sure then. But, yeah, before Todd Haynes took his crack at this as a concept, yeah, Eddie and the Cruisers does it first in 83, and just to dive right on into this film, the movie opens up, and we are presented with effectively a performance of Eddie and the Cruisers playing probably the single best song on the soundtrack, the one that's going to get played over and over again. And
oh,
which
it's
probably
a banger.
Yeah.
The Dark Side, which I am learning to play on guitar. It is absolute anthemic arena rock. It sounds exactly like that kind of Springsteen American power pop rock.
Yeah.
And it absolutely captures that. Michael Paré, with his slick hair and his black t-shirt with rolled up sleeves, holding the Fender, you know, wearing his blue jeans. He looks exactly like Bruce Springsteen. And then we realize, oh, this is supposed to be like 1963.
Yes.
It's like, so he traveled through time and brought reverb drums with him. And it's just immediately that sort of strikes the tension in the film, because what we're getting is very good. It's just certain trappings around what we're getting are really off-putting.
Well, it's the thing where, like, it's one thing to do a film where you start blending eras together. Like, you get stuff like, you know, at the extreme ends, you get things like Dark City or Tim Burton's Batman, where, you know, you're taking, like,
or Streets of Fire to an extent.
Exactly, where you're blending, like, different eras together and creating your own sort of amorphous, you know, place and time that does not correspond to the real world. That's happening here, but it's clearly by accident in this instance. It's not deliberate, and that'll be demonstrated as we see throughout not only what happens in the film, but also comments made by the filmmakers about their intentions, as you you can read about online. But
well, yeah, but like not to completely sidetrack a run through or anything, but like, have I ever told you how one of the most accidentally hilarious things in any movie comes from Walk the Line?
No, you have not told me this.
Okay, because there's the wonderful scene of them in the recording booth, and then the Sam Phillips character gives the, if you were dying on the side of the road and you could sing one song about your time on the planet, is that what you would sing? And then, you know, Johnny sings Folsom Prison Blues. And, you know, you're like, yes. And then the very next song he plays is Get Rhythm. And I was like, did we forget the lesson here? Or the same way that this is a film that also presents Eddie and the Cruisers capable of playing the dark side, and then the rest of it is like, Betty Lou got a new pair of shoes. Betty Lou got a new pair of shoes. Woo!
Well, and yeah, and as we go through it, this is going to be one of the weird aspects of this movie that we will get into. Folks,
and it's like, I'm an artist. I'm influenced by Rimbo.
Well, okay, yeah. So basically, it turns out why we're in the midst of this performance, which is mostly just close-ups of Michael Paré's face and then occasional cuts to the other side. Like, and when I say occasionally, like literally most of these opening 2 minutes is just a close-up of Michael Paré's face as he sings in the microphone.
And then you get this random cut to Tom Berenger playing piano.
which we'll come back to that as well. But we suddenly shift, and suddenly what we're seeing goes from film stock to video, and we realize that what we're seeing here is being watched by a group of individuals in a room with Ellen.
It's actually like, it's, I think this is a direct Citizen Kane nod, right?
Yeah,
because that one begins with Rosebud and the house and then cuts to the newsreel, more or less bringing everybody up to speed. And that's a shrewd enough way to do it, right? Because it moves the plot forward, it's a smooth transition, and it lays out all the exposition in a rational way, rather than characters being like, so, tell me about this Eddie fellow. It's more interesting than that to start a movie.
Well, exactly. And in this instance, what we have here is Ellen Barkin's Maggie Foley, a news reporter who's showing this performance to her bosses at, whether it's a national, presumably a national broadcasting network, based on what we're seeing here. But they're basically, it's like, yeah, we know Eddie's, you know, big. He was big in that 63. He's even bigger, seemingly bigger now. And she walks us through what happened, which is effectively, they hit it big with their first record there. They started recording a second one. One of the members of the band, Wendell Newton, dies, supposedly of a heart attack. We'll come back to that later on, because, man, some scenes are just unintentionally hilarious.
Spoiler alert, there is absolutely no plot, emotive, or thematic reason behind the Wendell reveal. So yeah. Wait for that when it happens.
Exactly. But yeah, and then Eddie, after storming out after a session,
because he started working on his follow-up, and what's key to that, Maggie explains, is she does the, have you ever heard of Arthur Rimbaud, the French poet who, for the movie's purposes, made a season in hell and then disappeared. Everyone thought he was dead, and then he was found alive, 20 years later on his deathbed. And she points out that Eddie was working on a controversial, dark, and brooding album called A Season in Hell that the label rejected. And then they point out that they never found Eddie's body, and so Maggie proposes, investigate that, and whether or not Eddie may still be alive. But the main reason is because after Eddie's death, the master tapes to the record were checked out of the studio, and no one has seen them since.
Exactly. So, basically, after it said, well, that's a great hook, where it's like, yes, for 48 hours, that would be a great hook. I mean, this makes a perfect
and
Friday
night. Honestly, this scene works, because in some ways, Ellen Barkin is selling us on the plot of the film. And it's like, okay, that sounds interesting enough. I'm on board.
And naturally, we then cut to Tom Berenger teaching Rambo to a bunch of high school students in what is one of my favorite, this doesn't happen in a classroom, for God's sakes, would somebody actually visit a high school one of these times? Where he's just wandering around the classroom while everybody pays rapt attention while he's reading some Rambo, asking, what does this mean?
Also, no one's wearing a mask.
Yeah. That too. It was 83, however, so I'm going to cut him some slack here. But point being here, but yes, this cuts, comes to an end, and then he sort of sits down in his chair, puts his feet up, and starts.
Looks nostalgic, flashes back to 20 years ago when he looked exactly the same.
Exactly. And this is where things, we start to see, because basically Eddie and his bandmates pull up outside the sort of dive bar where they're going to perform, and this is where you get the sense where Martin Davidson has a vision. He knows what he's going for, and has absolutely limited capacity to achieve what he's going for, because we get, like, I see what you're going for, where each member of the band wanders in one by one into this bar, while the young version of Frank Ridgway, Tom Berenger's character, looks in, starting with Joanne Carlino, played by Helen Schneider. And then we got Eddie showing up, and then we got Sal showing up, and then we've got, every member of the, or Kenny showing up. It's like every member of the band pops up one by one. Like, it's like, this is our big, group shot here, and this is supposed to be a moment of import. But it's just staged in such a ridiculous way, where it's like, This either has to be completely based on memory and you're just blowing it up bigger than it is and it comes off as ridiculous, or
well,
you
it's just like, it's not a gag, but it's not interesting.
Yeah.
It's a choice, though.
Yeah,
but like, they all just show up, and the payoff is they just ask to see the manager. And then the band is rehearsing on stage.
Yeah.
Which prompts an argument between Eddie and Sal over whether or not they should use emphatic pauses on the bass line.
Yeah.
To which they consult young Frank for advice, who happens to be reading Arthur Rimbaud.
Yes.
And, in what's a corny scene, but a well-delivered one, is Berenger then showing the difference. And then that convinces them. And from that point onward, good enough for Eddie, you're going to be part of the band. And I guess they figure that he can sort of learn to play piano. Well, and one of my absolute favorite parts of this film is for all the shots of Tom Berenger at a piano. You never see his hands on a piano. You never see his hands, period. You never see the piano keys. Tom Berenger is clearly not even remotely playing the piano in any of these shots, and it is hilarious.
Like, I almost get the feeling, like, was he cast, like, 2 weeks before shooting started? And it, or was, like, it's like, look, we're never going to shoot your hands. Don't worry, Tom. Just, like...
And, like, I get that part of the plot dynamic that is explored for maybe 20 minutes of a 90-minute film is, like, this latent class divide between Frank and Eddie and the rest of them. But... at the same time, it's just visually weird because you have Eddie and the Cruisers, cool 60s James Dean-style greasers, and then you have Tom Berenger dressed like an accountant not playing the piano. And it's like the video for Eye of the Tiger where all the guys are walking out in their black leather coats and berets, and then the one guy in a denim jacket with glasses walks with them. And yeah. It's like, what happened to your outfit?
Yeah. Well, and what makes it weird, we also see some of the tension in the band because, in this case, Sal, who wants, you know, who's, you know, written the song that they're performing, you know, Frank is very dismissive of him. And it's like, yeah, everybody but me, everybody but Sal knows what we're doing. And, like, every character member of the band has their one particular note to play, minus Wendell. Again, his
Well,
his
and also minus Kenny, the drummer, who just kind of disappears for most of the film.
Yeah, but when he pops up, our one-time Superman, my God, does he give... does he make his scene count? We'll say that, but we'll come back to that. But yeah, Frank's, you know, sort of, well... gets out of his daydreams by suddenly walking into his classroom is none other than Maggie, who wants to interview him for the report she's doing here. Now, number one, I always love the thing where, you know, reporters can just randomly show up at your place of work and just wander in. You would need to check into the office, Maggie, okay? You know, and they might tell you, have a seat. We will call him down.
That was happening while he was reminiscing, I am sure of it.
Possibly.
But yeah, and she, again, we're very much in Citizen Kane territory, except it's out of order, right? Because Kane very much follows the structure of the reporter meeting someone different, they talk about Kane, then we flash back, they present Kane very differently based on their relationship, and then back to them in the present. Here, we get the flashback first, then the reporter shows up, but it doesn't lead to a conversation. And from this point in the film onward, it follows the same structure as Citizen Kane, only it follows Tom Berenger doing it, not Ellen Barkin.
Well, and that's kind of the misstep here if you're trying to literally do Citizen Kane with film, because the whole point is that the reporter in Kane is an outsider. They have no take or opinion on this individual.
Yeah, instead we get the extended Frank remembering Eddie while he interacts with others in the present. And that's not to say it can't work, but it's not to say that it betrays a misreading of Kane or anything, but I mean, it's an attempt to innovate, or maybe it's an attempt to emulate that fails.
Well, I think it's definitely the latter, because the problem is that if, like, they deliberately were trying to evoke Kane in that sense, the problem is that, yeah, with Kane, we get a multifaceted look at that man, whereas instead here, everybody, you know, that Frank talks to gives pretty much the exact same opinion of Eddie. Like, there's no variation or difference on what everybody thinks.
This would be
thinks.
Like if Citizen Kane, from the moment that they interviewed Bernstein onward, just followed him around as he talked to other people. And, it just, I don't know, like, that already disrupts the idea of, like, trying to present, like, a complicated portrait of Eddie, because really it's a monolithic one.
Yeah.
The other problem is, like, there's something very kind of low stakes about the tension in the band, because it's not like Ray or Walk the Line, where in addition to like marital trouble and severe substance use disorder or anything like that as sort of the plot mechanic, like the difficulty in the band is not Eddie's self-destructiveness or not Eddie's vices, but it's his desire to make great art. And I mean, that's really it. And the problem is that that becomes his impetus to justify, you know, basically being a dick to everybody throughout the entire film. And that's as bad as it gets. But it all seems relatively tame. But then when you get down to it, it's like there are some bangers on the soundtrack. But like, it's just so weird to see the guy get off stage from going, Betty Lou got a new pair of shoes, and be like, no, man, if you're not going to make the greatest art, there's no point in even trying.
Well, and part of it as well is that what we're getting here, like, what you were describing, you might sit there and think, oh, this is going to be like a 2-hour drama that really dives into the history of the band. This is a very tightly compressed, like 90 minutes at most here.
Yeah.
So we are.
And it's like all that jazz is, I mean, that was a film that we looked at where I think one of our points of contention is for all the film presents, like Joe's downfall is his pursuit of perfection. It never really articulates why he has that desire. And at the same time, though, all that jazz is formally, and certainly in terms of, like, the artist's relationship to the object, a much more interesting film than this one, because Walter Davidson is writing about a person that's not real. Well, and it's like Eddie as a character. It's kind of my problem with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is that it sort of takes for granted that Sharon Tate, and whether she lives or dies, is symbolic of something, and things will be forever different because her fate is different, without ever articulating what or why.
Well, and I think here you're absolutely right. Well, I'll debate maybe a little bit with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but we'll save that for another time. The thing about it here is that, yeah, Eddie Wilson, and again, this is not a failing of Michael Paré. Michael Paré is doing everything that's asked for him, and he is charismatic. And that may be
the saddest part of all.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's just, he's doing everything he is, but the character of Eddie Wilson is a cipher at the end of the day. He's not really this embodied person. And part of the problem here as well is that, as we'll see over the rest of this film, is a lot of the supposed drama of what happens in the 60s is built around sort of a change in direction and evolution in music. But as we'll see, the film, it tells us that's happening. We're not actually witnessing it happening here or hearing it really as we get into it. And that sort of brings us to this point where, yes, when we come back to Frank saying no to Maggie, he returns home to his little house here and finds that it's been, somebody's broken in and, you know, raided the place fairly extensively. Exactly. And he gets a phone call while he's looking at this frustrated from none other than Doc Robbins, aka Joe Pantoliano in this case, who is a radio DJ now, but who was the band's manager back in the 60s. And he wants to see if Frank will come and see him down at the station.
Yeah.
And
they're congenial, but it also becomes clear that Doc knows that they're doing a story on Eddie and the lost record. And basically, he very strongly leans on Frank to get in on the action with him and find a way that, you know, they can make some money off of it. And I think key to that is him saying, because guys like us always get screwed over by these kinds of things. And what becomes a theme as Frank also talks to the bandmates, it's like a sense of, definitely a sense of like loss and nostalgia amongst the characters themselves, because you get the sense that, yeah, after the band broke up, things were never the same. And they were like, I think what's really interesting about this film and goes unexplored is, like, for as many biopics about Johnny Cash and that, you know, there's never really been one where it's the band and sort of like the aftermath after like the famous and celebrated one dies or something like that. This film sort of has the potential to explore that, and I think when it works best, it's sort of like leaning into that register. But most of it is more superficial, where it's like Doc is more like, well, let's get rich off of this thing, because I like money. And Frank refuses, the same way that he refused to talk to Maggie. And I like the line he gives where he's like, I knew Eddie very well. He was a very good friend of mine, and I just met you, so I'm not going to talk about it. And but he's also uninterested in Doc. So Doc asks him for a ride to his place, which is a seedy motel, lets him in and shows that his place has been ransacked too. And they figure out that somebody must be looking for the tapes because it's the only thing that either of them have that anyone could possibly want.
Well, exactly. Now, two other things. First, Doc also notes that Sal is currently basically doing an oldies hit show where,
Yeah,
you know, it's,
the
yeah.
tribute band featuring Sal, the original member.
Exactly. And the other big thing, and this is going to be one of the recurring things, is that because they cast most of these characters so young, and Tom Berenger, is that they end up using, in many instances, makeup to try and make them look older. And man, you can tell they're trying, but this makeup just doesn't quite look like. I keep saying it, but Joe Pantoliano looks like somebody took 1980s Tom Cruise and then tried to age him up in this instance by giving him male pattern baldness there and a very big
Yeah, it's an
forehead.
interesting look. But it's just they cast many people with very distinctive faces, and like a 20-year difference, it takes a little bit more to shape a person's face over time than what we see here. It's kind of cute. It's kind of like that. Come on, gang, let's put on a movie sort of vibe. It's more endearing than off-putting, I find, but yeah, you're not wrong.
And trust me, when we get to, you know, Doc's big moment towards the end, it just keeps adding to that feeling of let's put on a show here.
Yeah, but speaking of which, Frank eventually ends up going to see Sal's concert. And to the film's credit, like it nails the tone and presentation of sort of the revival act circuit very well in this scene. And we see that, yeah, Sal is certainly doing pretty all right for himself, but he very much is stuck in the past as well.
Well, it's the thing, because what we end up seeing is that Helen's there to interview, and at this point, Frank says, "All right, maybe I'll speak with you after the show." And we see the sound alike for Eddie go up on stage, which leads to another flashback. And this is where we see Frank basically, first of all, two things. One, they keep hinting that he has a romantic interest in Joanne in this one, which is highlighted by him standing at or sitting at a piano in that dive bar, seemingly working on something, and then heard talking about how it's like, "Oh, so you read poetry?" "Yeah, I do." And admittedly, an adorably written scene where it turns out she's just, "Oh yeah, I know about this," and just starts quoting stuff that she can clearly read off the back cover there, which he very quickly picks up on in this instance. But
Yeah,
this
and
leads.
like it's not that like the film is predicated on like a class struggle or something, but part of Frank's arc is that he is the fish out of water, right? He's the intellectual one, he is the shy, bookish one, he cannot play the piano, but his value though, and what Eddie sees in him, and again, this is something that the film just does not realize it's not doing correctly. His nickname is Word Man because he is the one that provides the band with the words. And we are told this from the beginning, but then they play, "Betty Lou got a new pair of shoes. Betty
Well,
Lou got a new pair of shoes. Woo!"
fairness to
And
this,
then, but there's the turning point in the film where like his contribution is made manifest, which we come to very soon. But You know, it's like prior to that, it's like how many of these songs was Frank actually writing? And after that point, how many other songs was Frank actually writing? Because the film goes to great lengths to emphasize, like, that's the bond between him and Eddie. So it's like, isn't this just as much like your music as anybody else's? It's like it raises more problems by just giving him the nickname of Word Man than it actually knows how to handle.
Well, and here's the thing. So, yeah, this to sort of lean into this, we come to Frank's big contribution to the band. And again, in terms of how this is staged, I do like it where we see that Frank can't really play, he can't really sing, and he's performing a early, slow, somber version of what will be Dark Side that everybody laughs at, and it's only the Eddie that recognizes the brilliance within it. But I want to take us back to American pop for a second here, folks, because the thing
I
about
definitely the emphasis on the piano in this scene, it definitely gave me Night Moves vibes. And today on YouTube, I had to isolate that scene and watch it because it's tremendous. And like, it's a genuinely greatly composed scene that also just happens to have some ridiculous elements to it. And you know, this doesn't quite hit that tier, but it's similar wavelength.
Well, it's the thing where we are again, they want us to believe that Frank is the big intellectual member of the band who's really going to push him. You know, he's reading Rambo, he's going to take us in this more artistic direction. And the song he comes up with is Dark Side. And look, I am not knocking Dark Side. I think we made it pretty clear. It's a killer track right at the start of this thing. But nobody listens to Dark Side and thinks, man, the insight into man and, you know, his place in the cosmos and what it means to be an emotional human being and the syncretic approach to human emotion. Like, nothing like that is going
Well, I guess
on.
it's the thing that a song like Dark Side, not to say that's a song anyone can write, or at least lyrically, but I guess the problem is like the film sort of uses Rimbo as a prop to be like, it's a big influence on me slash Eddie, I guess. Maybe it's not even clear if Eddie actually embraces Rimbo at any point, despite the initial framing. But like, there is no connection you can draw between Rimbo and the song Dark Side.
Well, exactly. And, but, you know, putting that aside, so I mean, which is a problem, but again, once they, you know, Eddie starts moving, it's like, no, we got to pick up the tempo. You got to learn how to play like this. And everybody starts jamming and they realize, yeah, we kind of got a hit number here on this
Yeah,
one. And
it sounds exactly like Bruce Springsteen, and it's great. But then you run into the problem again. This is supposed to be like 1964, and I looked it up. Like the top singles of that year were "Surfin' USA," and you know, it's so for a film that is so loving towards certain eras and can nail certain aspects of like the presentation of live music so well, it doesn't seem to realize that the key song does not fit the period that it's supposed to evoke.
Well, and that's exactly the thing. And what makes it is going to make it even weirder is by the end of this film, what we're supposed to have is almost like, you know, the Beach Boys going from Surfing USA to Pet Sounds kind of evolution type thing. And the problem is when you hear what they're coming up with, it legitimately does not sound remotely that much different from what they were A, already doing, and B, certainly does not sound like Pet Sounds or The Doors. Which The Doors in particular was what Davidson name checked. It's like, whatever the sound band we end up hiring, it's got to be able to reflect that evolution. I don't know how he saw that as being the case, but that's not what we get.
Yeah, there's not a Mellotron to be seen or heard. Yeah, but like, I guess At this point, though, there's the meeting between Sully and Frank backstage, and
Yeah.
Sully gets emotional, and they talk about just the idea of Eddie's death and really speaking on that. And Sully gets very emotive, and it's just that feeling of like, do you think he might be alive? And it's like, well, if he is, I'm just gonna get mad at him all over again. And like, there's something unspoken about the sense of everybody else's relationship to Eddie, but like, it doesn't reach David Mamet level, but it largely works for what it needs to do. And I think Sal in particular actually gives some surprisingly emotional moments.
Well, Matthew Lawrence, in a way, he's like the sense you get about his version of Sal is that this is the guy who really, more than anything else, he wanted just to be a rock star. It wasn't about being the greatest of the greatest. He just wanted to be up on stage, be very popular, and make a lot of money doing it. And
Yeah, it's like
his
the bassist in Jersey Boys, where it's like after a point, it's like, no, just I don't want to do this job anymore, you know? But I don't know. So he, yeah, like he's very much the down-to-earth one, and that gives us sort of his great line later in the film. But it's everybody wants something different out of rock and roll, like. But the thing is, like, it shows that this is what Sal wants, and Eddie clearly, as he explicitly states, wants to make great art because if you can't do that, what's the point? And it's never really at all clear what Frank's relationship to music as a person is.
Well, exactly. And this sort of leads us to he ends up meeting with Maggie after his meeting with Sal, and he starts walking her through, after Dark Side to come out and become a hit, the fact that they had to tour all these, areas, and Frank basically pushed them to play his old alma mater, in this instance,
Which is
by.
the preppiest of prep schools.
And the thing about it, again, is that it's so weird thinking that, like, because again, I like Tom Berenger, but I never get the sense of preppy per se from him. And not to mention, the first time we meet him, he's, working at a dive bar in this instance. So it's not like, I mean, first of all, was he finished college? Was he still paying for college? I'm not sure if he's what the actually happened here.
Yeah, there's just some amount of time. But also, like, this is the scene where I think the film really stumbles because this is also supposed to function as like the first real rift in the ideal world they are building. And it's centered around the fact that Eddie and the gang feel out of place amongst the elites. And there's no conflict though, like nobody gives them a hard time other than a couple stray looks. And by the time the band performs, the crowd immediately loves them. But as it's playing out, it's such like a point of tension between Eddie and Frank. And it's made worse when Frank ends up kissing Joanne, which Eddie witnesses at a distance.
Yeah, and eventually this explodes on stage with Eddie basically refusing to name check Frank, and then when somebody asks, and the audience points out to him, he starts giving this basic series of insults and refusing to use his real name, which,
Says
okay,
Toby Tyler, which I'm sure is a reference to something humorous. I don't know what that means. But the crowd loves Eddie and the Cruisers. They do great. But apparently, as Frank later puts it, the next day he left the band, but then Eddie tracked him down. They went for a walk, and he convinced him to stay because music and words, they'd stay together. And the two of them, they're like music and words.
Which begs so many questions where it's like, so basically you raise this problem to automatically solve it off screen in a way, in a scene we never see. Like, there's no
Yeah, like
time to
that would be
breathe.
an important scene to see, you know, rather than the gang goofing off before rehearsal.
Well, exactly. So Frank, at this point, first of all, Maggie basically just disappears from the movie at this point altogether, up
Yep.
until like the final few minutes. And Frank, goes on. He's still having these memories. He hears, I think, does he meet Joanne again at this point, or does he meet Kenny first?
I think he meets Kenny, who we don't necessarily realize why he's wearing a tuxedo and a bow tie in the daytime.
Yeah.
And then we later find out he's working in a casino. But, like, we get very little from Kenny. In fact, we get very little from him throughout the film.
Yeah.
And you'll notice we haven't mentioned Wendell, because he's in every scene, but he does not have dialogue. He plays the saxophone, and he stands there. Why is Wendell in the movie?
Well, not only that, but...
the reason is because that allows this scene to happen.
Okay.
Where Frank is basically trying to talk to Kenny, who basically tells him, like, stop romanticizing the past, because, yeah, there were good times, but think about the problems. Again, most of which we do not see, we are just told.
Yeah.
But basically reminding him of the personality dynamics, how when Joanne and Eddie would fight, no one would talk for days, and what happened with Wendell, to which Frank does not realize what he's talking about. And then Kenny gets like, you don't know what happened to Wendell? And
you're then gonna, when are you going to grow flashback. Up? Yeah, yeah, yeah. He chastises Frank. It's like, when are you going to grow up? Heart attack my foot in office. Because, yeah, Frank apparently, you know, buys into the official story that Wendell died of a heart attack. Now, look, first of all, I don't see any reason why people wouldn't buy into that, given that clearly Michael Antunes
is 25 years older than the rest of the band.
Exactly. Like, I don't know how these guys came into each other's orbit, but clearly something must have happened, which would make me laugh if it turns out he was supposed to be, like, you know, the exact same age as everybody else in the script, and they just didn't bother to rewrite it. But
the John C. Reilly treatment.
Exactly. But what makes it is, we have, you know, Kenny's big moment when he goes up to wake Wendell up for the show, and he's not pounding on the motel door. Nobody's answering. Pounds on it again. Nobody's answering. Come on, Wendell. Lifts up the window to the motel room, because apparently nobody kept this locked in the 1960s.
Then you see the rubber hose on the chest. So it's like, oh my God, of course. Walks into the bathroom. There's Wendell dead with a whole bunch of track marks on his leg. And that's the thing, because, again, this is a moment that's supposed to show, like, the dark side of rock, or, like, the turning moment downward. Somebody overdoses. The lifestyle gets to you. But Wendell is not developed as a character whatsoever. He doesn't speak. This is a moment that means nothing other than, oh yeah, the guy who died, it turns out he died slightly differently than how you thought you died. Also, I'm going to be mad at you for not knowing how he actually died, when evidently I went to lengths to cover up how he actually died.
Well, on top of which, it's like, at no point in this movie up to this time has the issue of drugs ever been raised in the
film. Like, they drink beer in every scene, but, like, there's never that point where, like, Eddie's too mangled, or, you know, there's no running plot line where it's like, hey, Wendell, you feeling okay? You seem a little off tonight. And then we get a reveal why, right? There are ways you could do it. This is just a thing that happens. And it doesn't impact the narrative at all, because, again, whether or not he died of a heroin overdose, the next scene functions exactly the same, which is them trying to sing the song Tender Years with the new replacement saxophonist. And then Eddie breaks down in tears and then announces that he buried his best friend a few days ago. He's told to come up here and perform, but he can't. And then Joanne takes over on vocals, and they sing the bummer remix of Tender Years.
And the thing is, I mean, it's one of those moments where I see what you're doing, Davidson. And, like, number one, I feel bad for the replacement, you know, saxophone. It's like, did anybody give him a heads up as to what he was walking into, number one, in this instance? It, like, because he doesn't get any dialogue at all. And there's got to be, like, the moment when, you know, Ridgeway's, or when Eddie says, you know, Wendell was one of the greatest saxophonists there ever was, and the guy's just, like, right there, it's like, thanks, Eddie, I guess I'm just, you know, second, you know, the cut rate replacement in this instance. It's like, you know, measure it out there. But yeah, we get this bummer performance, which is good. But yeah, we then cut back to the present day where it turns, you know, we then see
Frank. I think this is where Frank meets Joanne.
Yes.
And as we head into the end game and like the third act of the film, because yeah, we get to, at one the same time, Frank and Joanne meeting and sort of rekindling the old fire. And we get sort of like the missing piece of the story. At least you think there is until you actually start thinking about it. You realize a whole lot more is missing. Because next we get the big blow up scene. They're at the studio and they are playing the new record, A Season in Hell, for the executives. Now, David, before we even get into the film itself, there is a problem.
Yep.
Because throughout the entire film, we are being told that like Eddie had this record, he had this vision, you know, he had this dark and twisted masterpiece that he wanted to unveil on the world, and the world wasn't ready for it. You know, the preceding scene is Eddie clearly distraught by the death of Wendell and sort of him going to dark places, and then the unveiling of this. Eddie's not writing the words to it.
No, he is not.
And Frank, the guy who is just standing there watching everything happen. And I don't think the film sets up that dynamic on purpose. It forgets the affectations it has put on the characters, because so many of the ones put on are like Wendell's death, where it doesn't actually mean or affect anything. And then we get the scene itself. Dave, what's your take on Eddie's somber second record?
Well, first of all, you're right. You know, Frank's writing the words, but I'd like to note the one and only track we hear off of it, there are no words that we hear in the film to this track itself. So it's like, okay, that's problem number one. Number two, it's clearly, again, this is the song that's supposed to sound like we're moving into the Doors territory, the trippy 1960s psychedelic side of things. And again, once again, pointing to the fact that, again, nobody in this, you know, in this band, other than Wendell, apparently has been doing drugs at all that we can see. There is nothing remotely sounding like the Doors about this. Yeah. In fact, it's
there's a distortion pedal, but it's still a very conventional song.
Exactly. It's like, it's literally no different. But then we've got, I think it's, this is Kenny Vance's cameo, where he plays the record producer on this thing who's funded this whole thing. And he's like, there's no, you've been sitting in here for months working on this stuff. There's not a hit signal. I can't sell this.
I paid you a 10K advance and I expect something for my money. And you're giving me this?
Yeah.
And, you know, Doc intervenes and does that. Don't worry, we can fix it. He's like, there's no way to fix it. You got to tear the whole thing down. And that leads to the blow up between the band, where things come to a head, and Sal basically tells Eddie, look, let's just make the record and get our money, because, you know, that's what we're out here to do. And then Eddie gives his impassioned speech about, you know, aiming for greatness, to which Sal points out, but Eddie, we're not great, we're just a couple of guys from Jersey.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I do like the delivery and the sentiment of that line. Because, again, it speaks to the idea that not everybody wants to make art, you know? Not everybody approaches creating things for the same reason and geared towards the same outcomes. And, I mean, I think that's a fascinating topic. At this point in the film, though, you realize, I think, maybe it's key misstep, though, because we never get scenes of the process.
Yeah.
We only get scenes of the outcome, bar one, where it's the collaborative effort. But, like, otherwise, the songs and their relations to the characters in the movie are just kind of airdropped in, and we never see any of that be developed.
Yeah.
And I think that limits the film from having nearly the amount of impact that it could have.
Well, and this, speaking to your point, there are two big things. First of all, when Eddie storms out, you know, this is when Sal turns to Frank and tells him, this is your fault. And again, we have not really seen Frank have any impact on the band other than writing Darkside at this point in the movie, where it's like, again, if Frank has supposedly had some massive influence on Eddie in the direction of the band, we haven't seen it. But then this leads to one of the moments I had to burst out laughing when we reached this point, because we see Eddie driving away with Joanne at this point. Andrew, where does he drive her to?
They end up driving to a junkyard in the middle of nowhere where they move various things away. As Eddie explains, when he was a kid, he used to come here, and then unveils like this indoor kingdom of garbage that has been arranged into like a castle and has functional electricity and things. And then he gives, like, this almost Shakespearean monologue. This is Macbeth about to die upon the throne he has sacrificed everything for. As he pointed out, you look around here, all this junk. You got your Ford Edsels, you know, all your various obsolete things. And you got me. It's like, I'm the king of nothing. That's all I got. And it's like, because the record did not, like... Oh my god. It's just, you get back to the music itself, and it's like, this sounds like Asia, man. It's like when I listen to, you know, like late era Soundgarden in the car, or like Everclear, and my mom would be like, what is this acid rock? Like, it's not. Okay. Just moving on.
But what I love about this is Michael Paré is so committed to delivering this monologue.
But Michael Paré is not that kind of actor.
He's not, but my God, you can tell he's like, this is my Ozymandias.
It ends with him actually like raising fists triumphantly in the air and like screaming into the night.
Yeah, and then we cut, and again, and what I like is the shot, we then cut to from his perspective where there's literally nobody but Joanne in this big field of nothing in front of him, which, okay, I mean, that's a big moment, but this is also the point where a couple things, we cut back to the present day where it turns out that Joanne has been having somebody call her, singing
multiple times a day, and also has broken into her house. And this is sort of where all the threads come together, because Joanne then flashes back and gives almost like a drugstore cowboy-esque sort of scene. Yeah. They just drive to a parking lot, they hug, and she says, think about me and Eddie, we never talked about the future, but after that moment, I knew there wasn't going to be one. And he gets back in the car and drives off. There's the cut to white and the sound of an accident. Yeah. Did that happen immediately after? Or, you know, but then Joanne reveals, though, that she, after Eddie had died, she was the one who signed out the master tapes, and she knows where they are. Which takes Tom Berenger and Joanne back to the junkyard, the Palace of Depression, where they retrieve the tapes, while an unseen figure... who also is driving a perfect replica of Eddie's car that has been spotted outside Joanne's house, awaits in the distance.
And, okay, a couple things about this. First of all, I can understand Joanne maybe putting the tapes for sentimental reasons here. But this is
rained.
Exactly. Like, these tapes should be destroyed at this point. Like, they should not be in perfect working condition. I mean, that's the kicker when we get to the punchline of what, or well, not the punchline, but what this film's climax ultimately is. But they recover the tapes, but feel like they're being spied on. They get back to her place where her and Frank seem to be getting very close and almost romantically involved up until the phone call comes. And yes, it sounds like it's Eddie, but then there was a two rings that follow after this one. And according to Joanne, that was Eddie's secret message to get ready. They're going out here.
And this is where the film veers for 5 minutes into pure psychological horror territory.
Well,
because
yeah.
At this point, Joanne basically goes insane while the music starts swelling.
Well, yeah. And Frank suddenly gets the big idea of, he's going to take off, or is he? Because it turns out, no, he just parks down later somewhere further down the street and then walks back to a tree across from her apartment or from her house as, yes, quote unquote, Eddie in his car drives up. And
yes, and a shadowed silhouette opens the car door for Joanne. And then this moment of key tension is resolved by Tom Berenger opening a car door and then grabbing a man by the shoulder. This is not high stakes. But then we reveal the man posing as Eddie and presumably behind all of it is Doc Joey Pants. Now, here's the thing. Again, before we get into what follows, there's already a problem I could identify. What was Joey Pants' plan here?
Yeah, exactly.
Open the car door. Joanne gets in the car. Joanne sees not only that you're not Eddie, but that you're a person she can clearly identify. And then be like, hey there, give me the tapes.
Well, exactly. It makes no sense.
He later explains, though, that he has been doing all of this and he fesses up because he figured that Joanne knew where the tapes were. And he figured that she would never give them to him, but she might give them to Frank. So presumably for the last month, he's been calling her house multiple times a day and breaking into everybody's apartment so that she might give tapes to Frank. And then how would he get the tapes from Frank? This is the worst plan in the entire world.
Well, not only is it a worst plan in the entire world, like, I swear we are just one moment from Frank looking in the backseat and realizing, you got a hypodermic needle and chloroform there. What the hell? Just like literally, that's the only way this plan
this
makes
is like
any
long-standing
sense.
Gaslighting for a bunch of reel-to-reels. And it's even funnier because then Doc basically gives his, you know, sort of, look, I know that I'm a loser and I know that I never hit it big and I know that I kind of let you guys all down. You know, and I'm sorry for that. And Joanne tells him that Eddie said once that he always kept Doc around because he was a dreamer. And the world needs dreamers. And with that, she proceeds to give Doc the tapes anyway.
Which, okay, number one, God bless Joey Pantoliano at this point, because he suddenly gives his big, excited, I'm not going to let you guys down ever again. Don't you worry. Exactly. Doc is on the way.
You're going to hear about me, Mon Pa, and I don't mean from a postcard. But, like, at the same time, it's like, well, if this was a memory that she had and she knew that Eddie always liked Doc, and she gives him the tapes now, if he had asked her, then she probably would have. Otherwise, it's basically like, well, I wasn't convinced you were a man of honor, but after seeing the lengths to which you would go to secure this object that border on criminal harassment, I am going to give you this object. And it's played as like a moment of like bonding in a very weird way, and whatever it's aiming to do, I don't think this scene succeeds.
Well, there's two other problems to this as well. First of all, where did Doc get that car? Was he getting it on his DJ, you know, fees? He's doing, because I am reasonably sure that radio jockeys do not get paid terribly well. Two, even putting all of this aside, here's the next big problem with this. Joanne effectively stole the tapes. As far as I understand, none of them actually are in a position to be able to negotiate with anything with those tapes. Presumably, the person who paid for all of this still owns the damn things. So
there's $40,000 outstanding on that album contract if anybody is going to... And, like, it's okay, we have the master tapes. Like, because then we go from that to the tapes finally being, like, released as an album that fans can appreciate. But, like, it never explains that. It's like, it presupposes that we now have the tapes. We can mass-produce copies of this album ourselves by hand and distribute them without a record label getting involved at any point or being aware of this.
Well, exactly. It just makes no...
Also, we're reporting on this in a national news story as it's happening.
Well, okay, and this leads us to possibly the moment where, of all the things, of all the elements that have led us up to this point, we then get the kicker at the very end where, yes, we see Maggie delivering her final wishy-washy, yep, they were popular, and they're probably going to be popular still. And it took me a moment
to clue in where, why she is where she is in the clip, because... You know, it takes you a second. It's like, oh, that's where Eddie drove off the bridge. But it immediately cuts to her doing like no local news affiliate type footage quality of her in a crummy windbreaker just standing on a bridge in the middle of nowhere. And then she gives that, you know, the innocence of the 1950s gave way to the chaotic turbulence of the 1960s. And a figure like Eddie was a standard bearer of that point in time. And it's like, yep, few men sang about Betty Lou and a new pair of shoes like he did.
You gotta build sort of up
that, yeah. You know, and it caps off being like, well, Eddie wasn't appreciated in his time, but his music lives on, and he's finally finding the audience that he deserves. Yes, everyone truly now recognizes that Eddie was a genius. And as the credits roll, we notice that this is being played on a TV in a storefront window. And then it cuts to black, and we see a freeze frame of the unmistakable face of Michael Paré, who has a beard. But then it starts running footage again, after like a 5-second pause, to show us Eddie then, like, contentedly walking off into the night.
Okay, which raises so many questions at this point. Number one,
why didn't we just follow Eddie? The story of a guy who flamed out on a record deal eventually being appreciated in the present. That's fine. That's an Alexander Payne movie.
Well, on top of which, why did you fake your death in the first place? Literally, you could have just stopped playing music and done this. Not to mention, it begs all sorts of questions. And like, so after you fake your death, how did you...
It's like, oh, well, if I didn't fake my death, the media would hound me and never leave me alone. Like, my obsessive fandom would come after me. You're playing in bars, and you have, like, one song that some people like. This isn't Beatlemania.
Yeah, arguably Frank Zappa had a bigger following than you by that point in time in the 1960s. But even putting that aside, I mean, how did you get a new social insurance number? Whose identity are you living under in this point in time? Have you literally just...
What have you been doing?
Yeah.
You know, your whole thing was, if you can't be great at something, don't do it. So what's been up for the last 20 years? Are you the best upholsterer in Seattle? Like, you know, it's just, what have you been doing instead?
Do you want to know what the sequel suggests that he's been doing?
Is it something like he has been secretly writing hit songs for other artists?
Nope. He's apparently been like a lumberjack in Canada since that night there. And
oh,
he,
my
and,
God.
I haven't watched it yet, but I want to just because it's like, oh, so you're Dexter's, the most recent season of Dexter. Okay.
Well, it's also like, first off, it's transparent that this is how it's going to shake out. But it still manages to be a surprising scene only because it's just sort of atypical how they did it. And again, once the moment of Eddie's alive, you're like, this raises so many more issues. But like, you don't... The film, it's not that it spoils anything, but if you look at this film, it's like, it was also followed by a sequel, Eddie and the Cruisers 2, Eddie Lives, and it's like, okay, so that tells me all I need to know. So history carries a heavy burden. But yeah, that is how this film ends, a tight 90 minutes after it begins, and we are left... It doesn't work as a character study because it never develops its characters enough to be worthy of that endeavor or that label. So instead it ends up being, we see a bunch of tropes pontificate for a little while, and then they do things, and then some more things are done, and then the movie is over. That all being said, I adore this movie and I had so much fun watching it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's so earnest and so energetic, and like, there is that, like, it feels like a puppy dog that just really wants to make you happy. In the sense, like, I'm being good, right? I'm being good. This is one of the things, like, it so badly wants to be that. Yeah. And it ends up being remarkably endearing, and the things that work about it do work really well, most notably being that soundtrack, number one, which, as, you know, completely out of place as it is in the 1960s, is really friggin' good.
And, like, that's the thing, because, I mean, whenever we talk about a film that, like, sort of is remembered as a bomb, you sort of think, like, a certain scale and a certain level of poorness to it, like Razzie Award material. This movie, it's not that it ever gets, like, bad in that sense. It's just that it goes awry more than anything. There are definitely a lot of good elements, even aside from the soundtrack. Like, some of the performances or moments in the performances are actually really affecting.
Yeah.
There are some aspects of, like, the composition and the mise-en-scène that work really well. It's just, it's saddled with all of these extraneous details, and it feels like the focus went into details that are less central to making a film like this work the way it wants to than the ones that they actually choose. It's just clearly effort was put into this film, and not to say all that effort was wasted. It's just there's a lot of curious instances that you can identify where it's like, but why did you put effort here and not here?
Well, absolutely. But even then, I mean, it's there's also something incredibly charming because this is such a small scale film here. Like, I swear to God, the same bar doubles like as about three different bars in this movie while you're watching.
And, like,
it.
They do, you know, sort of the caveat of this film soundtrack is there's like three, four really good songs on the soundtrack. But they play those songs multiple times throughout the film.
Yeah.
So you kind of get the sense of, well, we got to kind of stretch out what we have.
Well, exactly. So, they're working within the restrictions. But again, it's to come back to my favorite, Don Coscarelli. There is that feeling of it's like, well, you're really making and trying to stretch your budget as far as you can. And things like... like, again, you might sit there and say, well, the college sequence. Well, why are Eddie and them even bothering to hang out at the college itself when they could be literally hang anywhere else until the show happens? I mean, well, part of it's probably because, hey, we licensed this college grounds for like 3 days and we're going to maximize as many shots as we can get and stage as much stuff here because we literally have spent the money doing it. So...
yeah, but it's like, why does that scene need to happen at all?
Well,
like,
yes.
It doesn't, like, you can achieve the same outcome that they're looking to do, which is namely introduce a conflict and move the plot along in a much more cost-effective way or a more sensible way. Because again, like, there are some aspects of this film that is so unharmonious with its own self.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. But, you know, nothing like tripping over the ottoman into a loving pratfall. And I think overall, I mean, that's kind of my attitude to this film. I'm not going to say it's a masterpiece, great art, or even necessarily good. But it's certainly a film that I enjoyed watching and a good one to start off 2022. Because it reminds us that perfection should not be the enemy of good or even sort of passable. And I mean, the soundtrack alone will give you the feels if you're of a certain age. But I guess getting into specifics, Dave, I think maybe we should turn to our patent pending closing segment, Hits and Pits.
Yes.
Where we celebrate and condemn the little things. So for a film that, despite 90 minutes of runtime, is filled with little things. Dave, why don't you go first? Give us your first hit for Eddie and the Cruisers.
Michael Paré. I mean, look, we've been critical about how the film handles the character of Eddie Wilson, but Michael Paré has got the exact right kind of chops and look and vibe for this character from frame one. Like, he is committed to being like the best leading man showman that he can be, and it works. And I mean, yeah, the character doesn't really add up to much, but there's never a moment in the film where I feel like Paré is out of place, or where you can't see that he's figuring out in his head why Eddie's doing it. It's just the rest of the film around it fails to communicate that to the audience in this instance. And I mean, I think part of why I also give it to him is that Paré is one of these guys who just, he got a real raw deal as the 80s went on. Like, a lot of people like to pick on him as like he was a bad actor. He's not. I think he's actually quite a good actor. Very limited.
I think he's an actor that sort of has a limited range of roles that they are
suitable for.
Not saying suitable for, even, but there's, they can play multiple roles, but there's a few that they are clearly a lot better at.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it's like there's, you certainly think that back in the boom period of movies, you know, that they could have found a bit more space for him. It's like two strikes and you're out. I mean, he's fun enough. And I mean, I'm not going to lie, like, for all of his strangeness as a performer in films like this and Streets of Fire, I mean, there is something I do love about Michael Paré. It's an ephemeral quality, but I do like him. He's sort of like the teen idol that wasn't. And in some ways, it's kind of fitting that he's the one playing Eddie here.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, it is a weirdly synchronous approach or combination of star and character in that way. Absolutely. But what about you? What would be your first hit for Eddie and the Cruisers?
Well, someone's going to say the soundtrack, so I'm going to say art director Gary Weist, who apparently worked on Dress to Kill, mostly because the staging of the various music sequences overall come off very well, despite some clear, like, limitations in scope and scale. Like, this isn't all that jazz, nor is it aiming to be, but, I mean, whether the tribute scene, in the club, the college performance, the opening scene, like, it's not as spectacular as Streets of Fire, even, but they certainly work effectively as music scenes in the film, and they all feel visually distinctive enough from each other. There is that tone of, like, light and dark sequences in the film visually as well that brightens it up, as opposed to everything these days being blue filtered. Overall, I mean, I think it's a film that certainly looks adequate to its funding, and you know, for what it is, it looks more than polished enough.
Well, yeah, and I'll build off of you with my last one, which is cinematographer Fred Murphy. This is a good-looking movie in terms of the lighting as well. Like, he gets a lot of atmosphere out of the sets, particularly those bar sets in particular. Like, he just sort of, the use of light, the use of shadow, it's really good stuff. And Murphy has gone on to have a pretty great career, along with working on things like Cue the Winged Serpent. He would go on to shoot things like Paul Schrader's Autofocus and the Trumbo biopic down the line there.
Yeah. And like you noted earlier that they sort of reuse certain sets, but you know, even just changes to the lighting and certain choices in the framing makes it feel different enough that it's not just reuse.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, I mean, they're being very conscious and cautious about how they're using their stuff there. And they don't try and, like, I mean, one of the risks of films like this is that they try and go bigger than they can afford to. And the end result is that they spread the money out and the resources out so far that everything looks cheap and tacky as opposed to that.
And it sort of just highlights the difference between what you're aiming for versus the kind of film that you're capable of making.
Exactly. And in this case, I think most of the time, the resource allocation went to the right areas, and Murphy certainly is one of the big contributors to that. But that leaves you, Andrew, with the last hit in this instance there. So I think I know where you're going to go with this, but
honestly, I do want to give it to Kenny Vance, but the most surprising one was Matthew Lawrence's performance.
Yeah.
Apparently he was the dad on 90210, and apparently worked on SNL for one season or something. Yeah. He is not hugely famous, but like, he gives a good performance, and like, there are some moments where he does a surprisingly emotionally resonant delivery from a character that is very stock.
Yeah.
I did like that, but who are we fooling? Kenny Vance, the score. Issues with its chronological placement aside. Like, again, the irony is, it's a movie that aims to make us remember the glorious 60s, when in actuality it makes us remember the glorious 80s. And the soundtrack is absolutely part of that. Setting aside when it's supposed to be happening, I mean, Dark Side, it's not a deep song. It's not operatic the same way Jim Steinman is. Instead, this is just like a great fist-pumping, Dire Straits-esque kind of rock and roll song.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I mean, John Cafferty, I mean, honestly, him and the Beaver Brown Band will always get overshadowed by Bruce Springsteen. But they were, they're just a really solid, great rock and roll act all around there. And again, they're not trying to present the, I mean, again, maybe in the great irony is that they are not the great band that you get the sense that Eddie Wilson at least vocalizes he wants to be.
Yeah, not every band can be the Beatles or even aims to. And I mean, the Brown Beaver Band certainly seems to be like the Sal type, where it's like, well, music is kind of a job more than anything. It's not like the ticket to superstardom or whatever. You're not remembered for, it's the workman-like approach to rock.
Well, exactly. I think that's, again, what sort of why, even with the anachronous sound of the band, it still works, because it's got that very working stiff vibe that fits with the band that we're actually seeing in the film itself here, in this instance. It's not like, you know, the well-cut, well-groomed Englishman coming over from the England there to invade the Americans.
Well, it's also the difference between, bands who sort of their primary pleasure is seeing them live and the experience they create there versus bands that make records, right?
Yeah.
Same reason there's party albums and there's headphone albums, right?
Yeah.
It's all of that there. This is definitely more, I think, party album music than headphone album music. The problem is that it's a film that desperately tries to convince you that that the tortured, angsty, cerebral rock that Eddie and his band are making is tortured and angsty cerebral rock. And it's not, it's great for what it is. It's just, let it be what it is and don't tell us it's another thing.
If only it had been Kathmandu. But
oh man, and I guess that's our slide into the inverse, the pits. Again, as we said, like, there's a lot of choices in this film that aren't necessarily bad as much as baffling. And I know for all the ones we've known, there's probably a few more, or some worth doubling back to. So Dave, what is your first pit for Eddie and the Cruisers?
It's gotta be the makeup. Like, I know I've hammered this home, but the aging makeup, not just on Joe Pantoliano, although that's easily the worst one. Even what they do with Helen Schneider, like, they try and make her look older, even though she still looks incredibly young, and their approach to it is, well, we'll just pancake more makeup on to her face. And as much as I was praising Fred Murphy here, and again, his work does deserve credit, under the lighting in this film, it is so obvious what they've done with the makeup on Schneider and Pantoliano, and to a lesser degree, David Wilson. This is Berenger and Matthew Lawrence. It's a bit, well, A, I don't think they did anything to Tom Berenger at all. And Matthew Lawrence, I get the feeling that they maybe just grayed his hair a bit, but he already kind of looks a little older in this instance. So I get, it works a bit better. But yeah, I mean, I get the problem. I get that you run into the, do we make, you know, Guy Pearce in Prometheus look that much older situation here, but you're going to notice it here, folks. And it's,
well,
not a,
you can also say though that, you know, you look at Citizen Kane, it's a tremendous film, but Joseph Cotton's age makeup, it does not look great.
True.
That's
yeah,
necessary evil, but it is kind of egregious in some cases here.
I guess
on that note, I'm going to follow like a more ephemeral thing that this film does that brings it down, which is the more we talk about it, it's like, this is a film that is so much, it says that it's about music, but really it's about the idea of music and more music as a symbol. Because again, there's no actual grappling with the creative process besides like paying lip service to tropes in music films.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, the character's very thin, and like, further emblematic, the fact that Wendell's in the film, but he's not actually playing the saxophone and he's not acting. Tom Berenger is like the focal point of the film, and he clearly doesn't even know how to mime playing a piano. Let's see them hands, Tom. And it's like, you know, this is a film that is concerned with telling a story about music and what it means without really grappling with what it means to make music.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. And I think we can pin all of that on Martin Davidson and Arlene Davidson's script. Like, at the end of the day, that's where the root of those problems stem from in this instance, because yeah, I fully believe they were totally invested in this and that they were very much putting their own feelings and about the era into it, but it's very clear that they're coming at it from the, we loved listening to the stuff and not, we loved playing the stuff or were fascinated by that. Like, they I get the feeling that most of their experience was, you know, we watched those golden oldie interview segments that Time Life used to put out. Those may not even have been a thing in the 1970s. I shouldn't say that. But
it's also like, what does Eddie even symbolize, though? You know, as like this sort of absence at the heart of the film. You know, it's like, what is being lost along with Eddie? Because if it's nostalgia for the past, it's Eddie is the one who wants to push his sound into a direction that the world isn't ready for. You know, so had he still been around, he would not be making that good old rock that, you know, you look back fondly on. And I mean, not to get too far into that, because eventually it's like, imagine the Beatles making an 80s rap influenced album. You know, imagine their UB40 style record. It's you know, the point is like, I don't know, this film just has such a weird relationship to music where you can tell that Walter Davidson probably isn't a musician in any way, shape, or form. Because again, like, this is a film where we watch people mention how important this as a craft and as a process is to them. We are never given privy to that, and the import of doing so is never explained to us. This is a film that takes a lot of its sort of, I think, core themes that it needs to explore as just assumptions or like things it tells the viewer once and expects to get like meaning from. And I mean, like, the ending as well is a weird twist to have in there. But it's like, if you cut that out, though, then how do you really resolve this story? Otherwise, it's just, well, the band that wasn't popular and then were, the end. Like, without that hook, you don't really have a reason for this film as is, because it's not evoking an era the way that it wants to. And I think you're right. It really flows from the script not knowing what to do with its iconography.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's really where every problem that we've discussed ultimately, it flows back to that script at the end of the day. And I think that also speaks to probably, again, I mean, even the structuring issues where we get Maggie introduced and then she disappears and then Frank's our focus and then, you know, suddenly it turns out that Doc, who was supposed to be our big character this whole time, like, because again, he just disappears from the movie after his one scene with Frank early on, and then we don't see him again until the very end of the movie. And I mean, it'd be one thing, again, because I think arguably the way this film should have been structured, given what they're doing, is that each and every single member of the band we meet is a suspect in some way. Like, imagine if that was the hook of the film, where it isn't so much, is Eddie still alive? It's which one of these SOBs stole the tapes and why did they do it and to what end? And we were literally following from Maggie trying to piece together. It's like, well, who would get that?
Well, here we already know that it wasn't Frank.
Well, exactly. And that would probably would have been worked in very, would have worked better. But I will say...
And then it turns out that Frank stole the tapes under the rationale that, no, Eddie got the credit for it, but I was the lyricist. This is as much my record as anyone's.
Yeah, exactly. Which would honestly make Frank's character make a hell of a lot more sense at the end
and
of the day.
And that would be the tension in the film. Again, the sort of front man versus the band. And then you don't necessarily need a murder mystery on top of that or a shocking reveal that Eddie's alive. You know, there's so much you can do with that material. And this film, like, overstuffs itself with gimmicks and one-offs to the point where it can't keep track of them and deliver meaningfully on them as a whole.
Well, exactly. But even if, you know, we had all these large structural issues, couldn't solve all those, at the very least, set up the junk palace early. For God's sakes, you can't just drop that in. You know, 20 minutes before the end of this thing. Like, you need to build up to that.
Exactly. Like, it's like something out of the movie Big. And it's just like, well, if we were living in this reality the whole time, shouldn't the earlier portion of the film been more magical? I don't know. At the same time, it is worth that reveal. You just can't watch it, enjoy it, and tell yourself this is masterpiece filmmaking or this is hitting the way it's supposed to hit. That being said, my life is richer for having seen Eddie and the Cruisers, and hopefully the rest of 2022 is going to treat us equally well for the year to come. And on that note, Dave, why don't you let everybody know where we'll be going to next time?
Well, you mentioned the Razzies earlier, and we're probably going to go with one of the most notorious films that I'm pretty sure was nominated for multiple ones in 1988. So we are going to be following Louis de Esposito, who briefly acts in a small role in Eddie and the Cruisers, to Ishtar, writer-director Elaine May's infamous 1987 comedy starring Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman in this instance here. And
yes, I have never seen it. I know as a kid, it was the go-to shorthand for box office bomb.
Exactly. It's had a little bit of a critical reevaluation in recent years. We certainly talked about May last year quite fondly in terms of the work she put in Wolf. So I am very curious to see this one for the first time and see how it shakes out. And surprisingly, we've never talked about Warren Beatty or Dustin Hoffman, I think, on this show prior. So
that's pretty remarkable. I like Dustin Hoffman, Beatty not so much, but we will be getting into that and many other furtive topics as we try and find some gold from the proverbial handful of dirt that was Eddie and the Cruisers. So stay tuned for Ishtar, and in the meantime, Dave, where can people get in touch with you?
Why, you can find me on social media at Twitter, at 24 panels per second. I'm always happy to have a civil conversation or discuss the awesomeness of the song The Dark Side. Andrew, where can people reach you?
You can find me on Twitter at FilmStripper, or you can email the show at FilmStripsPodcast@gmail.com. Yeah, I mean, I'm sick as a dog right now and yet to really have any downtime on the holiday, but I promise I will respond to most things before too many years go by. As always, you can stay up to date with us and rate and review us in iTunes or however you find us. 5-star reviews help move us up the featured charts, but more importantly, it's where you can leave some feedback. Leave a review, let us know what you like and what you don't, because as we enter another brave new world that is a brand new year, Dave and I have only ever wanted to do one thing, and that's bring you a show that you want to listen to.
Indeed. And on that note, Andrew, do you have any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes, David, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Then again, it might just be helping you fake your death so you can avoid your legion of fans or something. I don't know why you wanted yourself to be, pretend to be dead. Bye.
Corpses don't pay taxes.